Newman Catholic High School. Would they please stand?
Looking good.
Yeah, thank you for coming. You may be seated, please. The students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. It is a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We invite students to come, hear an oral argument, and meet with a justice during the noon hour. If the students accept the invitation, they're sent material about the case that they will be hearing. And they may engage in activities relating to that case in their classrooms. The students met with the students, that is from Monticello High School and from Monroe High School, during the noon, before the noon hour today, with Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. The conversation should have been about the procedures of the court in taking cases and hearing cases and deciding cases, not on the substantive issues of the case we're about to hear. If there's anyone in the courtroom who would like a summary of the case we're about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, we would give you a summary. Hearing none, I'll introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, with whom the students met. And to Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case today, 09AP1249CR, State versus Esteban M. Gonzalez. We have the following lineup. There will be two people arguing for Mr. Gonzalez. Mr. Shiro gets 15 minutes. Ms. Hodorowski, is that pronounced correctly? 10 minutes, 30 minutes for Assistant Attorney General Whalen, and 5 minutes in rebuttal for Mr. Shiro. With that, counsel, you may take the podium.
With the court, please. Attorney Whalen and my associate, Attorney Hodorowski. My name is Frank Joseph Skiro, and we represent Mr. Esteban Gonzalez and have the privilege to address this august court with regard to the matter before it on today's agenda. And I would respectfully offer the perspective in this address, coming from the history of having been a former first assistant district attorney for Milwaukee County for many years, wherein I had supervisory authority as well as conducted indeed on a regular basis charging conferences as they were designed to be. And I would suggest to the court respectfully that this case raised a number of red flags from its inception that were disregarded by the majority of the DAs who were assigned to it and also disregarded by the second judge who handled the trial in this matter, who now is retired. Mr. Gonzalez was originally charged for the first time in his life with 3 felony counts pursuant to Chapter 948 of the Criminal Code, the crimes against children. The state ultimately withdrew the gravest of these charges, first-degree sexual assault, after defense expert testimony convinced them that the state's forensic interrogation or video interview of the 3.5-year-old child, the subject of these cases, was unreasonably leading and suggestive and therefore unreliable. That left Mr. Gonzalez going to trial on the 2 remaining counts, both, of course, serious in their own right. Serious felonies. Count 1, the pornography count, charging him with exposing or exhibiting his child to harmful materials, contrary to 948.11, the harmful material being a pornographic video. Count 2, referred to as the self-masturbation count, charging him with intentionally causing his child to view such sexually explicit conduct, contrary to 948.055. It's important to note that these charges arose undisputedly from a single momentary incident lasting between 30 to 60 seconds in which Mr. Gonzalez, in his apartment in the living room, simultaneously watched a muted pornographic video and self-masturbated, at which time allegedly his 3 1/2-year-old daughter appeared in that room having left her bedroom. The jury found Mr. Gonzalez guilty of count one, the pornography count, but not guilty of the more severe count of intentionally causing his child to view his self-masturbation, notwithstanding the fact that both events allegedly occurred simultaneously. On his behalf, we present three major challenges to the appellate court affirmation of the judgment of conviction. The first two deal with proper jury management and instruction, or for that matter, in this case, may be improper. The third deals with procedural evidentiary rulings, which we respectfully assert essentially prohibited Mr. Gonzalez from providing any supportive credibility, testimony, or witnesses, and thereby providing him from having the full real controversy from being tried. As to the first two aspects, the jury instructions and the questions, noteworthy is the state's response brief appendix, which attaches the ABA Principles for Juries and Jury Trials, Section 15D. It has been studied by the Seventh Circuit American Jury Project. It has been endorsed by the 2006 Conference of Chief Justices, which also adopted a resolution encouraging the states to implement procedures and practices consistent with such principles. Although this court need not adopt that standard to rule in this case to determine if Mr. Gonzalez is entitled to a new trial, which we respectfully assert he is entitled to on numerous grounds, since it is a widely accepted suggested practice as to the best jury management practices, it certainly is worth consideration. But this principle, 15D, is relevant to his case because it sets forth, as supported by U.S. versus Bollenbach, addressed in our brief, when jurors submit a question during deliberations, the court, in consultation with the parties, should supply a prompt, complete, and responsive answer, or should explain to the jurors why it cannot do so. The lower court here did neither, as to count one, which we assert resulted in an inconsistent verdict of guilty. That in contrast to the not guilty verdict in count two, wherein the jury was adequately instructed as to the requisite mens rea, which was the intentional aspect, asking the jury to determine whether Mr. Gonzalez intentionally caused the child to view his self-masturbation. And they found that he did not and issued not guilty verdict. This court's former colleague, then Justice Jeanine Geske, in her well-reasoned dissent in the Lohmeyer case at 205 West 2nd 183, acknowledged the long-standing principle from State versus Schultz, also cited in the Lohmeyer case, that proper jury instruction is a crucial component of the fact-finding process. We assert it to be a critical stage of the criminal trial, and that assertion is supported by State versus Anderson, 291 West 2nd 673, and a host of other cases, U.S. and following. Justice Geske also opined that as long as the given jury instructions fully and fairly informs the jury of the applicable law, the circuit court has discretion in choosing which instruction to give. But the circuit court does not have the discretion to give an instruction which clouds or even nullifies the applicable law.
Counsel, what's wrong with this instruction? And we'll start with there. What's wrong with this instruction?
As to count one, Your Honor, what's wrong with it is that the standard instruction does not set forth any definition or even the word of knowing action targeted towards a specific minor child, which is the basis for the criminality of the charge. That's set forth in the digest of the standard instruction in the cases of State versus Thiel, Trojinski, and Booker. And the instruction just starts out with saying that if the defendant has a knowing or a knowledge, I should say, of the harmful material, mm-hmm. and then exposes, et cetera. but doesn't indicate that it has to be a knowing exhibition or exposure or playing. And that's the heart, and that smacks at the heart of the criminality aspect of it.
What you're going to have to convince me of, because when you read the statute, the knowing part doesn't connect with the exposure part. Whereas, you know, think of, for example, a sexual assault of a minor. The assault doesn't have to occur knowing that the minor is a minor. It's kind of a strict liability thing. If someone's under a certain age, doesn't matter if they looked like they weren't under a certain age. It doesn't matter if you knew they were under a certain age. And it doesn't require a knowing element. So not everything has a knowing element for every element of a crime. So I'm just telling you right now, that's the part I'm going to need some help getting over from you, because the knowing part comes with the knowledge of the character and content of the material, if you look at the statute.
Correct.
And what you're saying to me, it seems, is you kind of want us to rewrite the statute to say something else. And that's where you've got to help me over this, and help me realize how this is different than so many other crimes where there might be a mens rea for the overall kind of crime, but that doesn't mean knowledge is a part of every element.
Well,
did that make sense to you?
I believe so. Let me try this, Your Honor. Certainly with regard in this case, as to the age of the child, that was not in dispute. So that was not an issue with regard to their requirement of a knowing factor in that regard. However, it was clear from the cases digested in that standard that it has to be clear to the jury that the suspect or the actor has to knowingly exhibit the items to a targeted audience as opposed to accidentally or otherwise, notwithstanding the knowledge that the materials are harmful, which was not in dispute either in this case. But the statute as it reads itself and as supported by the cases that are digested in its standard instruction, clearly make that an aspect of an element of the charge. And to me, that determines the criminality of the charge. Otherwise, it begs the prospect that there may be someone who may have knowing harmful material being present in a room and a child being there accidentally, without the child being a target of its exposure, as is required by Trojinski and the rest.
So element one should have knowingly in it, the word knowingly.
I think
the defendant knowingly exhibited harmful material to named
yes.
child.
I would say yes. And that's what's absent there. But that's okay as long as it would be explained to the jury, because the case law says that's what's required. If the standard instruction doesn't have it, but it's supplemented by proper instructions, that would suffice. We offered and proffered amended instructions to address that precise issue. They were rejected.
Where did you get that? Where did you get the language for the supplementary instruction?
From the cases in Thiel, Trojinski, and Booker that were listed in the digest of the standard jury instruction, and then from research in those cases.
Did the circuit court give a reason for not accepting that?
Simply, the circuit court just simply said the standard instruction was adequate, went on to say that those terms that we were seeking to define by those cases, which was exhibiting, showing, and so forth, too, had a common everyday meaning and did not have a peculiar or special meaning in the law, which we submit that they do and did, as proof of the pudding was by the very questions asked of the jury, precisely as to what those terms meant.
Well, there's no question that the defendant deliberately exhibited that material to himself, knowingly, intentionally, deliberately exhibited it to himself or played it to himself.
That's correct, Judge. That's correct. And in fact, the state even concedes that the child was not probably the target of the video, if there was even any evidence that the child saw the video or was in the room, which was disputed. And we're suggesting and asserting that the proper application of the instruction requires that the pornographic material or this type of material has to be targeted towards a specific audience. And that was not done in this case. And the language was not clear in that case. And that's why in the seventh question of the jury that's asked with regard to the specific questions that came out over there, they asked the questions of explain exhibit, explain to, explain proximity. Precisely the questions that we had foretold may be a problem if the judge only used the standard instruction.
Is the standard instruction, in your view, inherently defective as it is written, or is it defective in relation to the facts of this case?
Certainly, as applied in this case, it was inadequate and therefore inaccurate. And according to Hurd, that means it was wrong or an error. And then the question becomes whether it was affected substantial rights, which we contend that it did. Standing alone without supplemental instructions with regard to the knowing aspect, especially if the jury asks substantive questions about the precise aspect of the action or conduct, then it's defective if it's not responded to. If the jury had no problem with that in a different type of case, it may have passed muster. In this case, I suggest it did not for both reasons. It was inadequate from the start, and particularly so when the court failed to respond to the substantive questions upon which criminality pivoted.
Counsel, sometimes instructions are not perfect, but we have opinions and plenty of them, and perhaps we've all written them, that deal with the concern that, okay, we don't take an instruction in isolation, but we read it in context of the other instructions, and oftentimes then say, good enough. And there may have been error, say good enough. Here, there was a theory of defense instruction that was requested that was also given. How, if at all, did the theory of defense instruction ameliorate the misinformation that you assert came from the standard instruction?
Well, it might have had the instruction been given, but it was rejected. And if it had been given by the court and accepted, then it might have created a balance at least for the jury to have an option. That balance, that choice wasn't allowed to this jury. And in reference to your first comment, Your Honor, I agree. But, you know, cases obviously each have their own life stream and their own life. And for years and years, it's a normal practice for instructions to be tailored to the facts of a specific case. So it's not uncommon, obviously, from a DA's perspective, from an AG's perspective or defense perspective, and the court's perspective, to ask for instructions that are submitted tailored to the case. For example, theory of defense instructions certainly fall within that purview as well as others.
Counsel, in count two, the statute explicitly states that the person intentionally caused the child to view or listen to the explicit conduct.
Correct.
Count one statute doesn't have that terminology in it.
Exactly.
Is it your position that the language of intentionally causing a child to view this is part of that statute?
I'm sorry,
is it part of the statute? Are you reading that into the statute?
The intentional part in count two?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Your Honor.
And were you getting it from the other cases?
Well, on count two...
Count two, it's in the statute.
Right.
Explicitly. Count one, it's not.
Oh, correct. I'm sorry.
And so what are you picking that up from the cases?
Yes.
Which case?
State versus Thiel, State versus Troshinsky, State versus Booker.
In Thiel, there was a direct attack on the statute as being unconstitutional if it didn't have the mens rea. Isn't that right?
I believe so.
And the court read in the affirmative act.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
All right. Is that why you say that the jury must have been confused between count one and count two, that count one didn't have to have it because they found him not guilty of two?
In essence, we're saying that because if you look at the questions, the substantive questions they asked, They ask the precise questions, trying to understand the proximity of the child to the actor. What did eye to eye mean? What did exhibit two mean? All of which revolved around the question of whether there was a conscious directed action towards a specific person or target, in this case a minor child, which those cases you cited require for criminality.
If the court doesn't agree with you, does it have to go back and look at the constitutionality of the statute without a mens rea?
Not on mens rea, with all due respect, Your Honor. We may have to look at the constitutionality of the standard instruction. Okay, not in mens rea. I believe, and it's my humble opinion, that the statute as it reads, unsupplemented, especially if indeed there are questions that ask for supplementation or clarification, there's a problem with the standard instruction.
That's the Thier case.
Thiel, Trochinsky, and Booker all taken together.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Sure. May I proceed? I'm sorry.
But your co-counsel, Kristen Ann Adarski, may proceed.
My apologies. I didn't see the light.
That's all right. She's got 10 minutes. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, the court. Counsel, good afternoon. My name is Kristen Hadarowski, and I, along with Frank Skiro, represent the defendant, Esteban Gonzalez. And here the pornography count instructions clouded whether criminal intent was required at all. And it clouded how Mr. Gonzalez's lack of intent defense applied or plugged into the substantive pornography count instruction. The defense at trial argued two alternative theories of defense. In a nutshell, we asserted that no knowing exposure occurred because as far as Mr. Gonzalez knew, his daughter never entered the room. She was asleep in bed, in her bedroom. But if the jury chose to believe that his daughter somehow caught a glimpse of the video, we argued that such exposure occurred accidentally and unbeknownst to Mr. Gonzalez.
So everyone should have a knowing, the word knowing, yes. Knowingly should be added to element one.
That may have assisted the jury in this case. Certainly it was not clear to the jury, based on their questions, that the word exhibit contemplates a knowing offer or presentation of material to the child. State versus Booker reaffirmed Thiel, and in that case, what they said is distinct from those cases involving a commercial display of materials to a general consumer audience. 948.11 focuses on the affirmative conduct of an individual towards a specific minor or minors. And therefore, the individual only violates the statute if he or she, aware of the nature of the material, quote, knowingly offers or presents for inspection to a specific minor materials defined as harmful to children.
Counsel, aren't there some conflicts in the statements given by your client? My understanding is that at one point he indicated that, indeed his daughter wandered into the room, that he may have allowed the pornographic movie or video to continue for 3 or 3.5 minutes. And then he gave other statements indicating it was an accident. So wasn't that kind of evidence presented to the jury here?
Yes, it was, to the extent that the police officers testified as to earlier statements that my client had made to the police. And also the written statement references a possible accidental exposure. However, he asserts that he was coerced into those statements, that they were not given voluntarily, and that he was really pressured. He was threatened with having his daughter taken away from him. And so under pressure, he cracked and he made those statements to the police, but that they weren't the truth. And so that was what was set forth at trial.
I want to get to something else that seemed to be a major part of the argument on behalf of your client, and that had to do with the jury management issues here. I haven't heard anything about those except at the very beginning. What specifically are you objecting to in regard to the management of the jury by Judge McMahon here?
Well, more than one thing. First and foremost, that the court waited 2 hours and 37 minutes to, for the very first time, alert counsel that the jury had asked questions. And so during that time, the jury continued to deliberate, and defense counsel was denied a meaningful opportunity to approach the court and propose answers to the jury's questions that may have resolved their confusion over the substantive law with which they were charged to apply.
Well, is part of that time taken up with having the jury go to lunch and also take a walk?
Possibly, but that's not clear in the record. We don't know how long lunch lasted. We don't know how long a walk may have lasted. We don't know when it occurred, if it occurred. We just were told by the court that that at some point happened. And really, there's no indication that it was in response to the jury's questions.
It's my understanding that while the judge did not respond to the jury questions, that she did ultimately call counsel, and that they were then arguing and discussing how to respond to these jury questions at the point when the jury returned a verdict. Is that fair in terms of the sequence of events?
Yes, that is what happened. During the time we were finally in court to present the proposed answers, the jury buzzed in with questions 7 and 8, which sort of restated questions 3 through 5. And again, they're asking about the meaning of the word exhibit. They're asking about the meaning of face-to-face contact. And specifically, they asked if eye-to-eye contact was required, which to me suggests that they wanted to know if Mr. Gonzalez had to know that she was in the room. They also asked if face-to-face contact required that she be in the room. And so, does that answer your question?
Well, I wouldn't give an A-plus to jury management by the judge in this situation. But what specific rights of the defendant are violated by what she did?
The constitutional and statutory right to be present at all critical stages of trial represented by counsel was violated here because the court waited too long to summon us to court to give us a meaningful opportunity to be heard. Because of the undue delay, for which no justification was ever provided, we were interrupted, and we ultimately were not able to get answers to the jury.
Counselor, how did if the young girl did not testify, how was there any evidence put before the jury that she was in the room at all when the video was playing?
Police officers testified that the defendant made earlier statements that she was. The defendant at trial testified that he never made those earlier statements, that at one point he heard a noise, he got up, he looked around, she wasn't there, and he returned to his chair.
There must have been something relayed to police that they based their charges on. Where did that come from?
The nexus of these charges actually started with a babysitter. Asked, and perhaps I can defer to co-counsel on this question. The nexus of these charges were excluded from evidence in this case. We weren't allowed to get into it. The child was excessively masturbating, which called attention and caused for concern for the babysitter. And so she contacted Child Protective Services, I believe, and they took a forensic videotaped interview, which was unnecessarily leading, suggestive, and so forth. We had actually Dr. Sandra Hewitt prepared to address the excessive masturbation as being just the result of the parents separating and going through a divorce, it being common among, I guess, three-and-a-half-year-old children, but we weren't allowed to get into that.
Okay, thank you.
So to continue here, or to wrap it up,
what is the standard that should be applied in terms of the judge responding to a jury's inquiry? I mean, is there some particular thing that you can point to that says that the judge violated some constitutional provision or statute or rule or case or what?
Well, the decision in Bolenbach by the U.S. Supreme Court specifically required, quote, when a jury makes explicit its difficulties, a trial judge should clear them away with complete accuracy. There's also comments in State versus Anderson and State versus Booth, which are both Wisconsin cases here, Booth coming from the Court of Appeals, Anderson having been decided by this court, that contemplate either a duty or an obligation to respond to jury questions. And I guess what we're asking for is a rule that requires that response be given within a reasonably prompt time frame and without any undue delay.
In counsel, I'm just thinking back in trying these cases, both as a lawyer and a judge. You try to get phone numbers for lawyers if they're not going to stay directly in the courtroom. You try to have access to them, but you can't always get a hold of people, particularly in Milwaukee County. People have other appearances. They have other things they need to do. Sometimes they go back to their office. Was it that the judge never even attempted to get a hold of anyone in any way and had all the information, had the numbers? Were the lawyers sitting right in the courtroom and the judge left to go do something else for a couple hours? What were the circumstances?
What happened here is, and I see that the red light's on, actually.
You may answer, counsel.
Thank you. The court took our phone numbers before we left. Our office is 5 minutes from the courthouse. We sat by our phone. The court took our cell phone as well as the office number. We waited for a phone call, and the phone call, ultimately came in at noon. The clerk advised, hey, go take lunch. Jurors are deliberating. There was never any indication at that point and during that phone call that the jury had asked questions and at that point that they'd been ignored for over an hour. We, as we were instructed to do so, called back in at 1:30, checked in, and at that time the court said, come on in, there's questions we got to address.
The court knew about the questions but didn't tell you?
That's correct. And respectfully, I think we're done. Unless there's other questions, my lady.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thanks, Maura Whalen, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court. I'm Maura Whalen here for the state. The core issue today is the relationship between the instructions the jury was originally given and the questions they asked. When and whether a trial court must inform counsel about jury questions is important as a general matter. However, in this case, unless the court's delay allowed the jury to convict Gonzalez on the basis of improper jury instructions, there was no reversible error. There seem to be two separate issues about the jury instructions that I think Mr. Shiro really sort of melded together in a way that I didn't really expect. I think that whether Mr. Gonzalez knew that his child was in the room looking at the video, the knowing question, is distinct from whether she was a target of that video. And I think that interestingly, the defense has argued consistently until today that the concern here is about the knowledge that he didn't know she was there and that the jury was not asked to make sure that they thought he knew she was there before they found him guilty. That's very different from the target issue. And I believe that what the jury was struggling with here was the target issue, not the knowledge issue. It was struggling with the question of whether Gonzalez could be guilty of exposing AG to harmful material when she was a known but uninvited viewer. That's the concern underlying the first substantive question. quote, clarify statement the defendant exhibited or played harmful material to AG. What does to say? And the later questions continued with that. I ask you, how should the circuit court have clarified this matter? In discussing question five, the court said again and again, to is an ordinary word that can't be further defined. That's correct. I don't think the court should have done anything more than told the jury to reread the original instructions. Now, Gonzalez did include in the special instructions requested something that addressed the unintended viewer question, and that language is, if you find that Gonzalez intended to present the adult video to any audience other than AG, then you must find that he did not exhibit it to her. And this language is based on Widener, which the case precluding liability for internet sellers whose intended adult audiences, unbeknownst to them, include a minor. Language applicable to anonymous internet sales is inapplicable to the present situation where the defendant's intended audience himself is unexpectedly enlarged by the arrival of an unintended but known viewer. And I think that if I could have a little hypothetical here.
Before you do
yes,
that.
Yes, okay, we might skip that. Yes.
Before you do that, is it your position that this statute requires for conviction that the accused know of and have affirmative conduct towards the specific minor or towards a minor? I mean, I'm reading from Thiel.
Well, you see, now, again, I feel that your question – I'm sorry. Yeah.
I'm reading from Thiel. We construe the term exhibit to mean to offer or present for inspection. This definition is in harmony with the statutory focus upon the affirmative conduct of an individual toward a specific minor or minors. Do you agree that that's what the statute says?
I agree that was an appropriate interpretation of the statute when looking at the internet context.
Was Thiel internet? I don't think so.
Maybe that was the movie house. I mean, that's right. I'm not sure. Widener was not the internet.
This was not an internet issue. And this was a charge about unconstitutionality of 948.11. Mm-hmm. On two grounds, at least. One is the affirmative act. That's what I've been calling a mens rea.
Right.
That is,
yes.
You know that there's a kid and you're directing it to the kid.
Yes.
And that was one issue. And the other issue in Thiel was what they call the variable obscenity, which is not involved in this case.
Right.
So the question is, that is how we're dealing with 948.11, right?
Right.
Hasn't been amended since Thiel. Thiel is 1994.
Yeah, well, it's been amended in the respect that it's been broadened. More verbs have been added. For example, play, which is important here, was not in the Thiel version.
Okay. But at least exhibit is what we're talking about here, right?
Right.
So does Thiel apply?
Well, I think that it's a matter of looking at knowing versus target.
Okay, I just want to know, does to be convicted of this crime, do you have to offer or present it for inspection and that the affirmative conduct of the individual is toward a specific minor or minors? I'll deal with target. Let's just deal with that.
Well, I think that the language about aiming it towards a specific minor, that's what I am calling the target language. And I do not think that specific minor target language is in the statute. And I think that it made sense for Thiel and other cases to talk about a specific minor because they were not presented with a case where here you have an exposure to a known but untargeted minor, an uninvited guest.
Why do they know? Why does he know that there's a minor? I mean, he knows there's a kid in the house.
Right.
Why does he know that the child is in the room?
Because he saw her, And there is, I agree with opposing counsel that he had many different statements. But in his signed statement, and according to Detective Edwards, I believe it was, he said, I saw her there looking at the video and I knew she was there. And so he knew she was there, but failed to turn the video off. He did not invite her. It was not his intention to have her there, but he had the knowledge that she was there. And I think that in the cases dealing with, and I'm sorry, I've gotten them mixed up, but the internet, another thing could be a movie house where older-looking minors came in with false ID or something like that, that the targeting language is important to distinguish those kinds of cases from the sort of internet predator case where a guy is really looking to expose a minor to pornography.
If you look at the statute itself, forget the jury instructions, mm-hmm. The statute's what he's convicted of, it says that if someone who knows the character, the material, plays to a child any harmful material, why isn't that an expression of targeting?
Well, I guess it's, I suppose target is not the clear word that I thought it was. I think that what I was trying to distinguish is the requirement that he deliberately chose to show that video to the child, as opposed to he deliberately chose to show the video to himself. He is his only intended audience, and the child happens to walk in, and rather than shutting it down, he permits that exposure to take to go on for 3 minutes. And by doing that, he is exhibiting or playing that video to the child. It wasn't his plan, but he didn't stop himself. I think there's somewhere where he says, you know, I got caught up in the moment. And that's what he was prosecuted for. He wasn't prosecuted for a plan of exposing the child to this as, this is what I'm going to do tonight. It was was something that happened, and he did not stop it when he knew that it was happening.
Okay, so it's your view that the jury verdict is supported by the officer's statements rather than by his own narration.
Well, their statements, including the written statement that he himself signed.
Counsel, do you agree that element one should have the word knowingly added to it?
Because I keep getting mixed up with one and two, you mean the pornography?
The defendant knowingly exhibited harmful material to name of child.
I think that it would not hurt. I do not think it is required. I think that, as the court said in Thiel, that the verbs in the statute, which are repeated in the jury instruction, connote that knowing exposure by their very force. So I don't think they're necessary, but I don't think it would hurt.
But you objected to the defendant putting in knowingly, because that's what he wanted.
Well,
you
mean I, the state?
The state. That's what he wanted to put in.
Right, yes, I know.
And knowingly sells, rents, exhibits, plays, blah, 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 blah.
I assume that the state objected to the whole thing. I don't remember. I mean, the main thing I remember is that the court rejected it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, frankly, if he had not asked for all of that other extra matter, possibly the court would have found it easier just to take knowing, but I'm just speculating there.
Was the video shown at trial?
Yes, it was, and that was an issue in the Court of Appeals, but Mr. Gonzalez is not pursuing it now.
Okay.
Not the whole thing, just a few seconds
right,
of it?
Right, I think what they can tell you, three or maybe the 3 minutes that she apparently watched.
Suppose, and was that put on as evidence by?
The state.
By the state. Suppose a child had walked into the courtroom while the video was being shown. How would you interpret the statute in relation to those facts?
That whoever is in charge, be it the DA, the bailiff, the court, I don't know enough about how trials actually happen, whoever is in charge of that video playing, they have to, I would think they'd have to turn it off. I mean, then we'd get into questions of immunity, but I think that they would have to turn it off.
How quickly?
As soon as they possibly could. And my guess is, again, not having tried a case like this, but I'm guessing the clerk or someone has the control in their hand, and they should turn it off right away.
Well, was the defendant charged with not turning off the video quickly enough?
He is charged with not stopping. Now, quickly enough, I don't know, maybe if it had been 15 seconds. In this case, what he did was he finished what he was doing, and he did not interrupt what he was doing. Whether if he had taken 15 seconds to turn it off, but affirmatively turned it off and stopped what he was doing, or a minute, I don't know. I can't say whether we would be here or not, but that isn't what happened. What happened was, it was on for 3 minutes, and that happened to coincide with the time he needed to finish his activities.
Well, now, Mr. Shiro, I thought he started out by saying that we're talking about 30 to 60 seconds.
Yeah, and I noted that in my notes in his argument. My recollection and Justice Crook's recollection is that it was 3 minutes. I can't tell you where in the record that is, but that is certainly what I consistently recall as being the testimony.
Okay, but, I mean, are you suggesting that the little three-and-a-half-year-old girl was watching for all 3 minutes?
I think that was the evidence that she was knew that she was there for 3 minutes watching the video. I mean, that was the evidence presented to the jury, which I assume they apparently believed.
So is the minute that he turned on the video, she was there?
No, he had been watching it for some time. And, I mean, I don't know how long. And it was when everything was underway that she appeared in the room. 3 minutes from the end of his activities. And I believe it is from his statement. I don't know if it's from his written statement. I guess that's something I can find fairly easily. Well, here I have Lieutenant Edwards reported that before preparing the written statement, Gonzalez admitted orally that it was 3 minutes. And at least in my quoting of the written statement, I don't see anything about the minutes there. And I suspect if the minutes had been in the written statement, I would have quoted that. So the 3 minutes must come from the Edwards testimony.
I'm kind of interested to know how this statute would apply if the child were 1 year old.
I mean, I assume that implicit in your question is a question about understanding what's going on and whether you would be affected by what was going on. And I don't know the answer to that. I think
I think a one-year-old probably would be affected. You could ask me about a two-month-old. Probably not. But this was
You're saying a one-year-old would be affected by this?
Yeah, I think so. Thinking back to not my own 1 year, but my children.
Those thrilling days of yesteryear.
Right. I think so.
Counsel, in response to a question asked by Justice Ziegler, looking at the statute and not seeing in the words of the statute a mens rea with regard to exhibiting or playing, I understood your answer to be that it might be a good idea to have that in there, that is a mens rea set forth. And yet, as I read the Thiel case, I see the Thiel case as an interpreting that statute as having a mens rea.
Yes.
Yeah. So it isn't to me just a matter of a, it. Maybe I misunderstood you. I think the statute requires a mens rea for exhibiting.
Maybe I misunderstood Justice Ziegler. The question I thought I was answering is should – I think we agree on what Thiel vis-a-vis the statute mean. I thought the question was should the jury instruction have the word knowingly in it? And that was the question to which I answered, I don't see how that could hurt. But I think that under Thiel it's not required because Thiel said these verbs, specifically exhibit two, connotes an affirmative act by its own force. Yes.
Well, did the judge give them Thiel? How does the jury know about Thiel?
Well, I agree with that. The jury doesn't know about Thiel, but the jury will interpret the words exhibit to, or what frankly I would have emphasized, the phrase play to, as a phrase that the jury will understand it requires an affirmative act. I do not think
okay,
that
play
he
requires an affirmative act, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about an affirmative act that deals with this child. I mean, he was exhibiting harmful material, wasn't he?
Right,
that isn't enough to come under this statute. What you have to have under the statute is a child.
Correct.
And not a lot of children. It's a specific child. A child. And then you have to have the child wasn't 18.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the person has to have face contact with the child before the exhibit. You didn't have it before the exhibit. It was during the exhibit.
There's a lot there.
Right.
In terms of play to or exhibit to, I do not think that you can play something or exhibit something to a person without knowing that you are playing or exhibiting something to a person.
You can have this child walk into the room and the father never see the child.
Then he didn't exhibit it to her because he doesn't know she's there. The two doesn't happen until he knows she's there.
And so you need know. That's what two means, know.
Well, I think that two, that the whole phrase, play to and exhibit to,
means
connotes the affirmative act.
Means knowingly play to.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So why isn't the jury instruction defective? If you need a case like Thiel to come all the way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court on that issue, how come the jury is supposed to know it? When it took a trial court and a court of appeals, I'm not sure there was a court of appeals here, the trial court and the Supreme Court took them to decide that you needed what I've been calling a mens rea here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would call
and
it mens rea,
too. And then you expect
too.
A jury of 12 lay people to understand that. Doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I think that it's inherent in the language, and I think that that's what certainly Thiel is a Supreme Court decision that the jury didn't read, but I think Thiel was based on the conclusion that the language itself connoted this affirmative act by the defendant. And I do think it's important about targeting a specific child or playing it to the specific child with the plan to play it to a specific child. I mean, I don't think the statute requires that sort of, oh, I'm going to put this child in my audience.
No, but it does require knowing that there is a child present.
I agree with that.
Okay, and that the child is under 18, and it does require knowing that it's harmful material.
Yeah.
And it does require that the accused has face-to-face contact, whatever that means.
No, it does not require that. That was a mistake that all of us, by us I mean the courts and the lawyers below, the face-to-face contact is not... Exactly. And I think he got sort of a freebie on this because the way the jury was instructed with throwing in the gratuitous face-to-face contact language, I think, helped to cement even further that the jury had to find that he knew she was there. And it's important, this question, I mean, the face-to-face language shouldn't have been there but Mr. Gonzalez also argues that they were confused by the face-to-face contact because when did it take place? It could have been yesterday. It could have been when he tucked her in. But the jury was not concerned about that in its confusion about face-to-face. It was not... He didn't want to know when the face-to-face contact happened. It wanted to know how close the child had to be and whether face-to-face meant eye-to-eye.
So this jury instruction was not correct because the judge didn't follow the instructions in the pattern instruction, which was that the alternative supported by the evidence should have been selected.
Yeah,
Instead, they just gave it all.
The court didn't notice the brackets. Yep.
Nor did counsel, apparently.
And nor did counsel, nor did I in the Court of Appeals. Then when I have my moot court, it seems that everybody in my unit knows do this except for me, so it's a little embarrassing.
On the internet.
He managed to read it, and he didn't notice that the word exhibit has a footnote that refers to Thiel, which says it has to be an knowing and affirmative act.
Right. Yeah. And I... Again, I mean, I'm sort of repeating and repeating, but that exhibit to or play to has to be a knowing and affirmative act. I don't see how you can play something to a person without knowing the person is there.
Well, that's
it happens to me all the time. I think I'm playing something. No one's listening, and my husband is in the background all the time. Just happens. I have a big bedroom. That explains that.
Well, on to the next topic.
On to the next topic. Well, the other thing that disturbs me is why didn't they allow all this information about his reputation for being truthful?
Well, as I said in the brief, I agree that the court misinterpreted the statute there. I think that it's a matter of harmless error. He has to show in order to have reversible error that his substantial right was affected. And A, we haven't been given enough information about what the women would have testified to know how it would have affected the trial. And B, this kind of my brother, son, is a truthful guy is probably not going to win the day because the jury is going to expect nice things from the family anyway. But also, despite what Mr. Gonzalez says about this being a credibility contest between the detectives and the defendant, this was a credibility contest between Gonzalez and Gonzalez. And when was he telling the truth? When he signed a signed statement or when he testified in court. And he speaks here today about, oh, my statements were coerced, et cetera. But he had a Miranda Goodchild hearing, and he lost it, and he appealed it in the Court of Appeals, and he lost it there, and he hasn't pursued it anymore. So I think we have to put to the side these allegations of the manipulation of his previous statements.
Ms. Whalen, what about the jury management issue? My understanding of opposing counsel is they're saying, look, this was a denial of the right to counsel at a critical stage of the proceedings. What's your response to that?
Well, my response to that I think is an easy question. I think he has never presented any legal authority to support that position. I think that there's just nothing. And I have researched it exhaustively myself. I found nothing. I think that what happened there was, at worst, an erroneous exercise of discretion. I think it is a discretionary problem. And I mean, I'm interested that the court hasn't really asked more about that. I know there are four former trial judges on the court, and I imagine that, you know, you might have some opinions about that.
Well, as I said before, certainly to me, this wouldn't get an A-plus in jury management. Mm-hmm. But the question becomes whether or not it's really a violation, at least to me, a violation of the right to counsel.
Well, I don't think it is, and I haven't seen any single legal authority to support that position.
Counsel, what about the Anderson case that talks about the circuit court's communications with the jury during deliberations are critical stages when the right to counsel may be necessary to protect the substantive rights of the accused?
Absolutely. But this was not a case of communication. This was a case of silence.
Oh, you know, if I am...
And one thing I just...
I can throw that back, but I won't.
I just want to say that something that surprised me in the reply brief is that the statement that the court communicated with the jury outside of the defendant's presence when it answered questions 1, 2, and 6, and that this was a constitutional critical stage. First of all, it's too late to raise that argument. We've never heard it before. But more importantly, that is a misrepresentation. Questions 1, 2, and 6 were about requesting exhibits. Prior to the jury's retirement to deliberate, the court and counsel agreed that the court could, without consulting counsel, provide exhibits to the jury if they requested them. And the court's giving the exhibits to the jury without notification or consultation was permissible under the prior agreement. Now, I wrote this in my Court of Appeals brief because I thought it might be relevant. It didn't, you know, he didn't mention it in his brief in chief, which is why I didn't re-raise it. I can give you, I don't know if you're interested in the record sites on this, but I can give them to you. The Court of Appeals said in note 4 on page 13, that these questions were about sending the exhibits back and no one had complained about them. So that was that.
What about the fact that the judge didn't allow this computer evidence of the defendant, that these pornographic matters were put on afterwards?
The expert proffered by the defense was totally inadequate. And I mean, I have that laid out in detail in my brief. He didn't have the general expert forensic computer experience to be giving this kind of testimony. He hadn't examined the laptop. He didn't know anything about it. I think that Gonzalez points out that there was some factual statements by the DA about, you know, the cops downloaded it and that changed the date. And I agree that it's unfortunate that this factual statement came in through the DA rather than an actual witness. But I guess I might ask you to take judicial notice, and well, no, I won't do that. I think that Judge McMahon made a decision in her role as trial judge evaluating expert evidence, expert testimony, that this expert was unqualified to give this testimony. And moreover, under the 90403 balancing test, this very weak testimony was outweighed by dangers of confusion and of prejudice, et cetera. And also, it's important to note that it's not as if Gonzalez said, well, I just want to bring in this testimony, this evidence of the dates on the image. Now, I don't think he could do that either, but unless he's just saying that, he's saying, I want to bring in this evidence with the accompanying interpretation that this evidence shows that the police manufactured the evidence. And without a valid, viable expert, he couldn't do that. Now, he quotes or cites record 88, page 88 for Dr. Welch's statement that, well, you don't need a forensic test to see what the creation dates were. But, of course, that's kind of a circular argument because Judge McMahon concluded that Welch wasn't qualified to give expert testimony on computer forensics. So then how can he be looked to tell us that forensic testing or, for, you know, a real computer forensic examination is necessary? I mean, that's just kind of a circular thing. And I think it would have been very prejudicial to Mr. Gonzalez to bring in this evidence of child pornography. But.
Are there any other questions? Hearing none, thank you, Ms. Whalen.
Thank you.
Mr. Shiro?
Court, please, I'm not quite sure where to start, but let me give it a whirl. First of all, with regard to the expert, undoubtedly, in my humble opinion, this expert was more than qualified to be able to give testimony with regard to the relevant facts and issues before the court. In fact, was found to be so by Judge Brosh before the court rotation and turned this case over to Judge McMahon. He was an expert. He's a professor at MSOE in Milwaukee, and he was an expert in computer science. He was qualified as such, and he was able as an expert either under the newly formed Daubert rule in Wisconsin now, as the federal court has, or the Wallstedt relevancy test in Wisconsin, I would submit, to be qualified and was accepted as such by Judge Brosh, the first presiding judge. We even started evidentiary testimony, and Judge Brosh made a finding that we could proceed with testimonial evidence to address the issue of whether there was egregious police misconduct. Well, we were never given the chance to do it, never given the chance to cross-examine the officers. And this indeed was a case of credibility, not unlike, with all due respect to counsel's assertion, that this was what did Mr. Gonzalez say from one time to the next, but rather, what did the police claim he said from one time to the next after he had been grilled extensively for hours upon hours, 2 days in a row, without the benefit of counsel or family to comfort him or to direct or guide him because of his trust for the police officers. But his statements, even the written statement that was the only one of two exhibits besides the pornographic video that was played, did not admit to the child being in the room for showing the video. It dealt with the masturbation clause for which he was found not guilty. So even the jury found that probably wasn't very compelling evidence at that point. So with regard to the experts, certainly under the rules of relevancy at the time, pre-Daubert here, the expert can opine upon hearsay, using hearsay, or other person's opinions. There was a forensic evaluation. It was the state lab report that was done by the state's expert. And took them a long time for them to even produce that for us after multiple requests. And only then, when we found that report, were we able to bring the motion. So we submit humbly that Dr. Welch was indeed qualified. The fact of the matter was that when this case was rotated to Judge McMahon, Judge McMahon, at a status conference, without allowing any other testimony, denied the motion without any further hearing. She, in effect, truncated the due process hearing that was ordered by a colleague, a judge of equal jurisdiction, and, in effect, if you will, novelly, I would submit, acted as an appellate court, overruling an order and finding of a colleague that there should be a probable cause hearing. That denied Mr. Gonzalez to be able to confront his witnesses. This was a credibility case in that smacked of the same nature as State versus Cuellar. It said when you're not allowed to have your credibility witnesses support your position, you're not allowed to have the trial. The real controversy has not been fully tried. And in this case, I submit to you, really hasn't been tried. But indeed, we submit to you that the expert was qualified, but we were prevented from having our due process hearing. That smacked against his substantial constitutional rights. That in and of itself, I would submit to the court, respectfully, would be a basis for a new trial in this case.
Did your client know that the polygraph would be admissible?
I'm sorry, ma'am?
Did your client know a polygraph would be admissible?
Not at the time. This was all before he had any counsel. He was grilled for 2 days in a row, once at his apartment, the other inside the inner sanctum of the suburban police station, by two or three police officers at a time without any assistance and without any counsel. And in fact, contrary to the state's assertion in their briefs, there is a record of that offer to proof that we were denied being given by the court who threatened us with contempt if we tried to raise it. We tried to raise the offer of proof in trial, and we were cut off. We raised it at the motion for suppression, and it was put in the record. And at motion for mistrial, at the close of the evidence, it was raised as a motion for mistrial, and we're denied. So there is a record in there. That issue was not waived for appellate purposes, in my humble estimation, and we were denied the opportunity to pursue that area. That's another issue that struck at the question of due process rights being violated. But with regard to the question of the state's position on critical stages of trial, it's axiomatic. State versus Anderson clearly sets forth the proposition about the critical stages of trial that we have here in Wisconsin that adopts the U.S. cases. And there is a host of them, in fact, that support that, and we have briefed that. Spencer versus State, 85 was second. Receiving a verdict in a criminal trial is a critical stage of the proceedings, and the defendant is entitled to the presence of defense counsel. Syverson versus O'Leary, Seventh Circuit Court decision, held that jury deliberations and the return of the verdict constitute criminal stages of criminal trial for purpose of the Sixth Amendment. Spencer versus State, Wisconsin case, receiving a verdict in a criminal trial is a critical stage of the proceedings, and the defendant is entitled to the presence of defense counsel. The prime the pump concept that was referenced by the defense counsel in the Anderson case a few years ago is also critical in this case. Therefore, several hours we were unaware of the fact that the jury had asked substantive questions that dealt with the essential elements of the offense that would form criminality, that had to do with mens rea. We were unaware of it. We're not even called about that. And we were told eventually that come to the court and we're not even advised that those questions have been asked. After we came, and my office is less than 5 minutes away from the courthouse. I could run there faster if I needed to, okay, and would have. The DA's office is right in the same courthouse complex. So in this case, we're not talking about a question of distance trying to gather the troops. We were there and could have been there at any moment of time. But we were not told about those questions. And we didn't have the opportunity to prime the pump, if you will, for a critical stage of the proceedings to allow for us to ask the judge at that stage to answer these questions that we think were critical and vital. And of course they were critical and vital. Why? Because they asked the very questions that smack at the heart of the criminality of the offense, the essential elements, which were missing from the standard instruction as to the knowing aspect, not to the harmful material, which was stipulated to, but to the directed, targeted actions towards another minor child, as set forth in Thiel, Trischinski, and Booker, and those that follow that proposition. Here, if the court please, the fact of the matter is that jurors are entitled to have their questions answered. And not all jury questions are equal. But certainly when they're substantive questions, that deal with the heart of the criminality statute, the mens rea, and the juries make explicit their confusion, the courts must have a duty to clarify that confusion.
Well, the judge could have just said, reread the instructions. They always do that.
Oftentimes they do. And when, with all due respect, Your Honor, if the instructions are adequate, that might have been fine. But I submit to you, in this case, they were not. And in fact, that because they were not adequate, they were incorrect, according to her. And then the question becomes, was there substantial prejudice to the defendant? And we assert it was, because of the nature of the questions being asked, that smacked at the heart of the charge. And I think it is demonstrated almost just by logic when we look at the fact that how can one assume that this jury could have found and count two that he intentionally exhibited this children to his self-masturbation on one hand, failed to exhibit intentional masturbation on one hand, simultaneously within 30 to 60 seconds, not 3 minutes like the police testified to, and that was a credibility issue also. Okay. And then not knowingly show this
child. There are other elements, Counselor, as you know, to that second charge. He has to have done it for his own sexual gratification or the humiliation of the witness. I think there's a little bit more to that charge than
you're
whether
correct.
He knowingly.
You're correct. There are those other elements. There are those other elements. Correct. But underlying that certainly is the issue of intentional. And there had to be an intentional display, if you will, or exposure to the child. The reason for it, the motive for it, is another aspect. And the jury would have to find that also to convict. But they would also, in order to convict, have to find he intentionally demonstrated that to the child, and they found not. So it doesn't stand to reason logically that during the same episode that both could coexist without referencing an inconsistent verdict, which we submit occurred here.
Was there a special verdict wherein you knew why they found him not guilty of the second charge?
Was there a special verdict?
Excuse me.
God bless you.
Yeah. Well, you know, in a civil case, we often have special verdicts where you take the charge apart point by point. My experience generally with criminal cases is either they're guilty or not guilty
right.
of the crime charge, period, right?
Correct.
That's what it was here.
Correct. There was
so
no special
really
verdict.
You don't really know why they didn't convict. You don't really know why they didn't convict him of the second charge. It could have been intent. It could have been the other parts of the crime that also have to be proved.
I guess I can't go into the juror's mind. Certainly.
No. That's my point. I don't think
right.
we really know why.
But we just humbly submit that the elements with regard to intent that are criminal mens rea in that charge
mm-hmm.
are one reason why they didn't find him, because he testified he didn't do that. And even with the statement that was given to the police. But indeed, this was an issue of credibility between three police officers and my client, mm-hmm. not between my client's one statement and another. That's their statements of his and mine. And no one ever testified to, number one, whether the child was in the room other than the police officer's assertion. And if the police officer said that it was 3 minutes in that room, there was no independent evidence or anything to support it.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. And I see my lights are on, and I apologize if I went over. Yeah.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Any other questions? That concludes, thank you, counsel. That
thank
concludes
you.
Our hearing in 09 AP 1249 CR, State versus Esteban M. Gonzalez. Yet again, a challenge to the elements of the crime here of 948.112A. Thank you, Ms. Hardwarski, and thank you, Ms. Whalen, for your arguments today. The court is in recess until tomorrow on our final argument, and court will meet in conference at 3:20. We are in recess.